Hi. Remember January? A long time ago, eh? Yeah. January came and went, February, March, April, and here we are in May. Can you believe it's not only the last day of classes, but the last afternoon of classes? Yes! You made it. You made it. Okay. That's a milestone, you know. Review sessions. I have requested time and room for 2:30 on Friday and 4 on Monday. I haven't received confirmation yet, so when I do, I will email the entire class and let you know when and where those will be. There is a theoretical possibility that there won't be a room available at one of those times because all the relatively large rooms are tied up in exams, but I'll let you know, and I will also put it on the website. Okay. The exam is Tuesday at 4. Here. You will need a number 2 pencil for the exam and any other writing implement of your choice. Sidewalk chalk does not do well. And red pen is not acceptable because I can't read it. Because I'm holding a red pen while I'm reading and it just confuses me. Okay, so don't do that. If you are taking the exam in the proctoring center, please email me and remind me so that I can have the exams there. Any other housekeeping details? Questions? Final exam covers everything. Everything related to this course, the context of the family context of human development. Okay. All right. Okay, I want this to be interactive for a little while, so I'd like to do a couple of exercises with you. And the major one, we'll get to in a minute, is about separation and divorce. And what I'd like you to be thinking about is how you would apply a developmental perspective to understanding the changes that take place as a family goes through parental separation and divorce. So put on your thinking caps about that. One little exercise first. Before we do that, I'd like you to join me in singing a little tune that's familiar to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Julie. Happy birthday to you. And it really is today. So she's going to dinner tonight, but she doesn't know where. How many of you waitress in fancy restaurants or wait staff? I'm sorry. Okay. So, you know, if you see Julie come in. Okay. You made it. She's officially an adult now. I'm not going to tell. How old do you think she is? How much? 23? 24? Other guesses? 25?
A little older.
28? 30. Yes. Okay. See? exercise, good food, no smoking, no drinking, no carousing, good relationships, major in human development and family studies, and you too. Can look like you're 25 or 23 when you're 30. Okay. But she is still to be trusted. I'm not, but she is. Okay. You're welcome. Okay. So as you think about separation and divorce, and this is a major change in family constellation. We think about the family being restructured. There are several points that are important in thinking about separation and divorce, and many of you have been through it, so some of this is pretty familiar to you. One of the issues that's important, in my view, is that divorce isn't an event. It's really not an ecological transition. It's a series of ecological transitions. It's a process. And it's a process that begins probably when the parents who are going to separate, or the couple who are going to separate if they're not parents, it probably begins in their childhoods. Or certainly in their adolescence or in their courtship experience, and then it's exasperated as the family experiences the conflict between parents. Parents almost never separate and divorce when they love each other very much and are happy in the relationship. People get married when they love each other very much and are happy in the relationship, but then things change. Remember I said that I can give a lecture on what happens when you have a child or how to ruin a perfectly good relationship. There are lots of things that ruin good relationships in addition to trying to parent. But as you proceed down the rocky path that leads to separation and divorce, there are a series of ecological transitions. And it's not helpful to think about divorce as an event. It's a process, as I said, that begins often many years before the couple actually do get divorced. And it's a process that continues until they are fully divorced, if they ever become fully divorced. And fully divorced means that they are no longer able to push each other's buttons. They no longer have issues with each other. They have either resolved those or put them aside, and they are continuing their own lives free of each other. That can happen very quickly for some couples. It happens over a long period of time for others, and it never happens for some divorced couples. They stay married to each other emotionally until one of them dies. And they continue to have conflict and arguments long after one would hope that they could have resolved them, or at least gotten past them. As you think about the process, the easiest place to start is with conflict. So when you're thinking about the parental dyad, as you're beginning to have problems in the dyad, affect is becoming more negative. Reciprocity may take a different turn. It may become, instead of positive reciprocity, it may become negative reciprocity, where people are taking turns annoying and hurting each other, criticizing each other. And power gets re-explored during conflict. So sometimes the conflict is about power and its unequal distribution in the dyad. Sometimes the conflict is about wanting to change power. Sometimes it's about how people assert power in the relationship. And one of the things that happens as couples are falling apart is that they're trying to gain power. And they may do that in ways that are harmful or certainly hurtful to the relationship, as they threaten, try to steal money, kidnap kids, do all of those things that some of you have experienced as your parents tried to figure out who had more power as they were separating. What happens to the parent-child dyads when parents are having conflict? Bronfenbrenner talks about the ability of one dyad, the capacity of one dyad to support or to influence the other dyads that people in the original dyad participate in. So if you have mom and dad experiencing conflict in their dyad, then their dyads with any children that they have are likely to suffer. Parents who are having conflict with each other are either spilling that conflict over onto children, they're neglecting children because their time and energy are being spent in the conflict in the parental dyad. Sometimes people will place more emphasis and engage in odd ways in the parent-child dyad because the parental dyad is unsatisfying. If you have older children, often parents will change the roles in the parent-child dyad and expect the children to take care of them. They adultify or parentify the children. And some of you have been and have described the fact that for periods of time when your parents were separating, you were taking care of them, or taking care of the household, or taking care of other siblings. Anna?
When my parents started having conflicts, they kind of gave me more attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that as kind of them wanting me on their side, so they spent more time with me, they spent more time with me.
Mm-hmm. Anna's observation is that when her parents were fighting with each other, they both spent more time and energy and placed more importance on their relationship with her. And her interpretation of that was that she felt that they were trying to get her to be on their side. And we call that triangulation. You try to find an ally, because there's strength in numbers. If you want more power, then trying to convince the child to be on your side gives you more power. It also gives you the ammunition against the other parent that you're having conflict with. It's one of the reasons that parents pay more attention to their children. It's not the only reason. Sometimes they do it because they're concerned about what the conflict is doing to the child, and they want to make sure the child has joint activities and lots of affection and positive affect. So there are good reasons to spend more time with your children when you're fighting with your partner too. But certainly the potential is there to abuse that relationship as you try to get the children to take sides. Okay, so there are lots of potential effects on the parent-child dyad. And during the process of separation, when one person leaves the household, when the parents separate, they're not living together, then the opportunity for day-to-day contact, hour-to-hour contact, joint activities, and positive affect with the child may be greatly diminished. So that dyad, the parent-child dyad, may be greatly at risk. And if parents have so much conflict that one of them can't be with children, then what children are experiencing is the loss of the regular contact with that person with whom they're in a primary dyad. And some of you have had the experience of having parents disappear, not be present, not be available for periods of time while they were separated and divorced. And sometimes, for many kids, that's a long-term separation from the parent, in the parent-child dyad. Some parents don't know how to maintain the relationship, how to keep it with a high level of reciprocity and a lot of joint activities if they're not living in the same household. There are too many barriers for them. And parents who are concerned about hurting the child will often fade because there's so much conflict around trying to maintain the relationship that, and so much unpleasant feeling about it that they disappear. At the extreme, that is represented by parents who literally drop out of the child's life entirely. And one of the changes in the macro system, I'm going to talk about several changes in the culture and how we deal with divorce over the next half hour or so. One of the major changes in the macro system is that people used to advise. Intelligent people with PhDs in psychology used to advise fathers particularly to drop out of their children's lives. And there were books written not that long ago, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, about dealing with divorce and as parents that literally advised fathers who rarely got custody of their children, advised them to drop out of their child's life, to cut off contact so that the child could move on and so that the father would not be confusing the child. It's very painful to go back and read those books at this point, but if you've had in previous generations in your families or people that you know, in previous generations, if people have been have had those painful experiences of having fathers particularly disappear, it's important to know that the macro system encouraged that. That fathers were typically considered to be at fault and they were encouraged to atone for their faults by leaving the family that they had destroyed or broken up. The family was now broken, it was Dad's fault, he needed to be banished, and he needed to cooperate with that banishment. That's not the way we see it anymore. The macro system has changed dramatically in the last 40 years as we've moved to understanding the problems that disappearing parents create for children's development. You think about the ecosystem as parents separate, they're creating another setting where the child is likely to be expected to participate. And so what happens is that children, as their parents separate, often find themselves not in a home microsystem, one particular setting with both parents and siblings, but rather a home mesosystem. And as you think about that separation and its continuation through the divorce and possibly remarriage of the parents, what many of you experienced was a mesosystem, and all of Bronfenbrenner's hypotheses about the mesosystem can be applied. The consensus, the congruence, the common goals between those two settings for the child who is the primary link are important. The communication between those two settings, the compatibility of roles in those two settings is important to the child's adjustment. So if you think about a kid having what we now call a binuclear family with two settings for the parents, separate settings, they're creating a home mesosystem. And the goal is to make that mesosystem as facilitating of the child's development as possible. Just as you would any other pair of settings in which the child participated. But that's difficult if parents don't talk to each other, if they blame each other, if they fight each other. Think about the hypothesis Bronfenbrenner has about having a positive attitude and primary positive affect, primary relationships with people in the other setting, in your mesosystem. That's a prescription for parents getting along. It's a prescription that says parents should not badmouth each other, particularly to the child. They should, in fact, be supportive of each other. They should have direct communication. They should have positive affect between them and engage in activities with the child in both settings or support the child's activities in each setting. That's not what some of you experienced, clearly. What we describe, I use the term a binuclear family. I love this graphic of it because it looks like two eggs sunny side up in the skillet. This is mom's house and this is dad's house. And those are settings. So it's a mesosystem for the child. The macrosystem has changed because what happened originally was that what used to happen is that you had a nuclear family in a home setting, and the way divorce was conceptualized was that one of the parents had become unfit by having an affair, being an alcoholic, being abusive, whatever it was, and so you threw that person, you ejected that parent out of the family because that person was at fault. So you banished that parent. And that let parents, as they went into the divorce process, it let them get into the battle of proving that the other person was at fault, which leads to court battles that are Kramer versus Kramer and worse. And what that left was a family with only one parent. So we referred to families that had been broken by divorce. They were now incomplete. They were now one-parent families. And the use of the term one-parent family for a formally married family is part of the foundation for having the parent disappear. If you're no longer part of the family and you've been thrown out of it, then it's probably best if you slink off into the forest and hope you survive on your own. And because we've ejected you, you're not welcome anymore. But over the years, looking at families that divorce well, and I use primarily Connie Aaron's book, The Good Divorce. I know, you don't think there can be a good divorce. It's all relative. But Aaron's is a psychologist and family therapist who spent most of her career studying families longitudinally. And she deliberately went out to find families in which the children were well-adjusted and doing well and there was low level of conflict. And she describes in her book, The Good Divorce, how people do that. And she coined or adopted the term binuclear family. Because what works, she's documented, and Hetherington and others have supported it, is that the old view doesn't work because of all of the losses that children experience. What works is to think about the family as now having two settings, two nuclei, each parent. From the child's point of view, the old model was difficult. The view of the world that you were getting was, I'm now in a broken family. I'm now in a different kind of family. It's one parent. I don't know where my other parent went, but clearly my other parent did something wrong. And so I have a difficult relationship with that person, and the society doesn't support me in maintaining it. From the child's point of view in the divorce that works, this is the family. And all the children are in it, and all the pets, and all the grandparents, and all the aunts and uncles. Because from a child's point of view, everybody who's related is part of the family. And if you go back to our first discussion of family, who is in your family and what, how do you define a family, many of you who have binuclear families put everybody in it, including the pets. And what happens then to create a good adjustment for the children, good development continuing for them, is that this becomes a facilitating mesosystem. And the parents are able to engage in activities together, go to the weddings, go to graduation, go to school plays and concerts and all of those sorts of things, and not throw things at each other, not throw punches at each other, not insult each other, but be civil and avoid the negativity between those two settings. And then if you're really good and want to do the good divorce, then you accept into that family, as children want to, in when they're adjusting well, you accept dad's girlfriend into that family, and dad's girlfriend understands that this is the package that she's joining, and that she is expected, as she joins it, to have a positive relationship with the children and with mom. If she doesn't, she's on her way to becoming the evil stepmother. And that's the way to become an evil stepmother. Have a bad relationship with the children and with their mother, and you're out of there. And that's one of the reasons that remarriages after divorce with children have a higher divorce rate than first marriages. And the same goes for mom's girlfriend. When she comes into the family, she is supposed to have a positive relationship with the children and the other parent, and vice versa. Everybody who comes in to the child's ecosystem, if they're going to have primary dyadic relationships with either parent or with the child, can be guided by a developmental perspective. Here's the kid. My responsibility as an adult is to help this ecosystem facilitate this kid's development. And that means I need to work on my relationships with everybody. I need to support the child's relationship with everybody. I need to engage in positively affected communication. I need to engage in reciprocity. Sometimes people say, how can you be reciprocal with the other parent? Bronfenbrenner didn't invent reciprocity. He took it from lots of other studies. One of them you're familiar with is one that concludes, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's the golden rule. You're familiar with it probably. That is a prescription for reciprocity. Treat other people the way you would like them to treat you, and you're likely to be establishing positive reciprocity. You'd like to be accepted? Try accepting the other people. You'd like to have people do nice things for you? Try doing nice things for them. You'd like them to speak well of you? Speak well of them. That's reciprocity, and that's what's missing often when a family is doing a bad divorce. And when they're continuing the conflict and they're failing to create a mesosystem, an ecosystem that supports the child's development. the roles change. And one of the major changes in the roles is that when you have mom and dad in the same space carrying out tasks in the household, they tend, they don't have to, but they tend, just as they did, as we talked about in cohabitation, when people start to cohabit and they are two different sexes, there is pressure as you move into that new microsystem to engage in traditional stereotypic male and female roles. No matter what you think you're going to do, no matter what you've been raised to do, the pressure of the macro system is there. You have to fight it. As parents parent, they're likely to have that pressure pushing them toward division of labor. They do different things. They don't do the same things in the household. And if that's gone on for 8 or 10 or 15 years, they're very comfortable doing things that are different, and they have rationalizations for that. Well, we're both doing the same amount of work, but I'm better at this, he's better at that, she's better at this, I'm better at that. So we divide them up. And that includes the parent-child relationships. And the research is pretty clear that women do the majority of the emotional work in families. They're the ones who take care of people's feelings. Not in all families, but that's what the tendency is. The women do the emotional work. Dads typically have much less experience with that and are less good at it. So they get less practice because mom is doing it. And over the years, the difference may build up. Doesn't have to, and you can fight it. But when you put mom and dad in separate settings, they can't do that division of labor. Being a co-parent in the same setting when you're married is quite different from being a single parent, a parent alone, when you're in a different setting, when you're in a unique setting that the other person isn't in. So what happens is that you still have to do everything, but there's only one person to do it. So your role changes, the activities change, and the dyads with children change. And they're up for grabs for a little while. So there's some adjustment taking place. And it's an important period of adjustment for parents to figure out how to be the only parent in the household and to maintain or create now a relationship in which everything gets done and the children are emotionally supported and the laundry gets done and all those other things that you may not be comfortable doing or may not feel you have time to do. But what happens is that both parents potentially are going to change the way they are human. They're going to change their activities. They're going to change the way they relate to children. They're going to diversify. They're going to become more differentiated, but more similar to each other. And that's the fun part. That parents actually become different kinds of human beings as a result of being the only parent in the household. Same thing happens to widows, same thing, and widowers. The same thing happens to people whose husbands or wives are deployed in Iraq for a year. If you don't have the other person in the household, your repertoire expands. And that's a wonderful time to rethink how you parent. People don't believe that it's going to happen, particularly the former spouse. They're assuming that this parent has never been good at particular activities. There's no reason why he or she can be expected to. But in fact, that's not true. Because the ecosystem is going to change, the new setting is going to be different, the people in it and the relationships are going to be different. You're going to adapt to that new setting. And if you have support for becoming more competent, you're likely to do that. And what typically happens as a result of divorce is that both parents see parenting differently, if they engage in it. They don't have to. They can bail. They can avoid being parents. So one of the pieces of advice is to take that role seriously and focus on it until you get it down before you start dating. That's Uncle Larry's advice to your parents. Isn't that fun?
It was pretty funny.
Thank you for the illustration. I wish I had it on videotape of her going, but for those of you who didn't hear and for those of you who are listening on the website, the observation is that Dad used the moving boxes for furniture the first couple of years and didn't realize that he was responsible for little brother's hygiene, like brushing your teeth and showering. But over the couple or 3 years, he got it together. He figured out he was responsible for this, and he figured out how to do it. And we're not even going to ask whether it was some girlfriend who clued him in. We're not asking. We're gonna assume that he actually figured this out on his own. We're gonna assume that he didn't call in reinforcements from family of origin, grandmothers. So he figured it out on his own. We're going to assume that, even though it's not true. And he figured out that he was responsible for this, and when Mom finally got in the door, she was a little surprised. That's typical. It's typical that men get it together. Sometimes it takes us a while, but sometimes we do it pretty quickly. It's one of the reasons that it's helpful for men to have lived on their own before you marry them. And they've lived on their own, not letting somebody else take care of them, but they've figured out how to manage an apartment, clean, cook, feed themselves, grocery shop, clean the refrigerator, and all that other stuff, so that they're good divorced husband material. They'll also be better husbands if they've done that. They know those skills. Okay. As the roles change, the relationship between Mom and Dad also has to change. And what often happens is that people assume no change in the partner, as I suggested before. What happens is that people are very surprised that people are actually doing a good job in what they're doing and are enjoying it. And that leads often, when I'm working with the family court or with parents, one of the things that comes up as a source of conflict is that when the couple were dividing the labor and taking different roles within the household when they were together, it often meant that Mom was doing the emotional work and Mom was spending a lot of time supervising children and Dad was spending much less time doing that. But as a single parent, Dad gets much more interested and connected to children and enjoys the role of parent. And as he's doing that, sometimes discovers that every other weekend and a Wednesday night a month is not doing it for him, for his relationship with the children. So he suggests, as part of the negotiation, that maybe the kids could spend more time with him. And mothers almost always interpret that as an offense against them and reject it. And typically respond to it as if this is, A, it's unbelievable that he would actually want to spend time with the children. He's trying to interfere in my relationship with the children, and it's a power play on his part. I don't know what he wants, but I'm going to reject it out of hand because he wasn't involved before. I can't believe that he wants to be involved now. What Mom is really hoping is that he'll disappear completely, and what he's doing is saying, I don't want to disappear. I'm enjoying parenting, and I want more time parenting. So what happens then is you get conflict, and a view of the world and the other person that is not helpful to the co-parenting relationship. So one of the things I try to do with parents is to warn them that if they don't do equal time at the beginning, they need to be prepared to renegotiate that as they discover the joys of their new roles. And that people can want to spend more time with the children, not because they want to deprive the other parent, but because they in fact want more time and a better relationship with the children. Dating brings the new boyfriends and girlfriends in, and that complicates the ecosystem for children. It complicates the ecosystem for parents. It complicates their relationship, because you can be perhaps on pretty good terms until there's a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend. And when the other person begins to be in a new dyadic relationship, it may be more difficult to support that person in that relationship. So jealousy and conflict reemerge as, I think, an expectable part of the dating experience as people are moving toward establishing a new life. The dating experience makes the mesosystem and potentially the microsystem different for children. You're bringing a new person into their lives. And some parents do that precipitously. So they give kids who are still reeling from the separation, they give kids a new stepmother or a new stepfather instantly and expect them to accept that and adjust to it and be enthusiastic about it. And most people aren't. Most children aren't enthusiastic about having another adult. If you think about Bronfenbrenner, the number of primary dyadic relationships that children have with more developed people in a variety of roles, the more kinds of differentiated transactions that children can have with people in their microsystems, the more highly developed they're going to be. Does that apply to binuclear families? Theoretically, the potential is there to have four parents, eight grandparents, biological siblings, half-siblings, step-siblings in two different households. Some of you have written about how incredibly complex your divorced families were. And a couple of you in your papers pointed out that actually Bronfenbrenner would suggest that that was good for your development, and now that you think about it, it probably was. Assuming that everybody's engaging in positive affect, that there's agreement between the settings, that people have reciprocal, equal-powered relationships. If you're being abused by your step-sibling, that's probably not good for you. But if all the relationships are relatively good and parents are dealing with them relatively well, then kids become more flexible. It's like being a super middle child. You have more adults to relate to, you have more settings to go into, you have more activities to engage in. So if you really wanted to chase that, everybody ought to get divorced and remarried so that all the kids have multiple parents. Okay, don't. But think about, and this is a change in the way you think about families, think about kids in that situation as potentially advantaged. And if you're in the situation, conduct yourselves in a way that make it an advantage to the children to have complex families. And in the good divorces, that's what Aaron's describes. The fun thing for me is, if you read The Good Divorce, and I recommend that you do that sometime, especially if your parents are divorced, you'll be able to categorize your parents. Are they fiery foes or are they best pals? Aarons describes in the introduction her own divorce, and she had a daughter. And she describes it as a bad divorce. And her relationship with her ex-husband was a very highly conflictful and negative relationship. And she said the event, this is an ecological transition of some sort, I'm not sure how, but the event that changed her perspective on it was not just the research that she was doing, but the funeral for one of her daughter's grandparents. And I've forgotten whether it was one of her parents or her husband's parents, ex-husband's parents. But anyway, they were at the funeral. Her husband had a new partner who had been involved in the daughter's life for quite a while. I think they were married. So she was stepmother to Connie's daughter. And Connie describes being at the cemetery for the interment, and it started to rain. And as they were leaving the cemetery, her daughter's stepmother was near Connie's daughter, whom she was possessive of. And the stepmother took off her own coat and put it around Connie's daughter so she wouldn't get chilled in the rain. And Connie describes it, and she usually has tears in her eyes when she describes it. She suddenly realized that her daughter had two loving parents and a loving stepmother to take care of her, and that was an advantage, that her daughter's life had been enriched by having a stepmother who was doing a wonderful job of loving her daughter. Said from that point on, she was able to accept that relationship and celebrate it, because she realized that the stepmother wasn't competing, she wasn't being an evil stepmother, she wasn't taking love away from Connie, she was just loving this teenager at that time. And that she'd been doing that for a long time, but Connie didn't have enough contact with them to actually see the nature of that relationship. And the conflict between the parents had kept Connie's daughter from talking to her mother about the stepmother. She knew, because of the conflict, that her mother was not comfortable, so she just simply kept what was going on at Mom's house separate. And many of you have had the experience of having your parents tell you sometimes in words, but in very clear ways, that it was not safe for you to be having a good time in the other household, in the other setting, and that it shouldn't be shared. And that's not good from a developmental perspective, because it cuts down on, it may preserve the neutral affect, or at least not make it negative. But it also robs you of the possibility of having positive view of what's going on in the other setting for the child. Blended families, when people remarry and new kids come in to the setting, make that binuclear family even more complex. But it was apparent to you that the parents had different interpretations of their biological children and their non-biological children, their stepchildren. Right. Right. That kind of situation is fairly typical, and some of you who have step-siblings felt that that your step-siblings were favored by their biological parent and you were not. It's fairly rare for a stepchild to feel more acceptable and more highly valued than the biological child. It's very rare. It happens occasionally when the biological child is a real screw-up. Then the stepchild may be trotted out as, oh, this is the kind of kid you ought to be, and I wish you were. That's a process of shaming the biological child. You do understand why that is. So when you have a step-sibling of the same age, the comparisons are inevitable, and the potential competition between step-children, between step-siblings, is almost inevitable. Let me provide a guiding suggestion about figuring out what's going on in step-families, and that comes from sociobiology, which sometimes gets a bad rap, but the basis of sociobiology is that our social interactions and our social arrangements are designed to preserve our genes. And from a sociobiological perspective, an exaggerated form of that, a human being and his or her relationships is a gene's way of reproducing itself. So your DNA wants to replicate. That's what it's about. And all of our social interactions can be interpreted as a way of getting our genes spread and duplicated and replicated and on, so that our progeny are widespread and hybridized, which is good for genes. So if you think about the evil stepmother, the sociobiological explanation for that is, well, that's pretty obvious. They're not her kids. So she will prefer her own biological progeny. Every parent will prefer his or her own biological progeny and want them to survive and thrive and reproduce as a way of passing on the genes from the parent to the child to the next generation. It's a fun way to think about it. And if you're a biologist, it's fairly obvious.
I have a friend whose dad remarried, and she has now two older stepsisters, and this was all around the time that they were entering college, like choosing colleges and stuff. So the two stepsisters decided that they both wanted to go to Baylor, which is a private university in Texas, and because of this, she was forced to go to a community college where they paid for both of the stepsisters' college in full, bought them new Mini Cooper cars, matching cars, and she's driving an old car and is forced to pay for her own college. And the dad can't do anything about it because the stepmom is like,
Mom has all, stepmom has all the power.
Dad's like forced to send her money through the mail, like secretly, so the stepmom doesn't know.
Yeah. Poor stepchild.
Yeah.
One of the issues in remarriage, particularly with children, is that you're doubling, tripling, quadrupling what happened when you got married. Let me see if I can draw it. Let me challenge you to draw it. When you marry, you bring in your family of origin, right? And two people bring in their family of origin perspectives, and then they have to try to fit them together into a new microsystem in their dyad. But they both bring expectations and standards, norms from their family of origin. And anytime you cohabit, anytime you marry, you're going to be experiencing the blending of those two backgrounds. In divorce, you have those, you've blended them in the family of procreation. You've put it together some way. You've created your own expectations as a couple, or you haven't, which may be why you're separating and divorcing. And when you start to date, you do the whole thing over again. So you bring in a new partner who brings in his or her family of origin, and the variation on that, if the new partner has been married, what you've established in a family of procreation, and you try to blend those. And you have children who see the family of procreation as their family of origin, which has been problematic as the parents are separating. They are bringing in a different history, so the children and stepchildren are bringing in different history from their families of origin. The parents are bringing in what they created in their family of procreation, and now they're trying to put all of that together into a new microsystem, a new pattern, which includes how you think about money, what kinds of traditions you have, how you celebrate holidays, how you communicate with people. And stepfamilies are, as some of you know, just incredibly complex. And it takes years for families to sort out how they're going to do things. The differential treatment of step-siblings is common, particularly when people remarry when their children are in high school or college, because in the family of procreation, they have created a set of expectations for their own children. And those expectations may be very different. For example, in one family, the expectation may be that you pay for college yourself. It's your responsibility. And if we help you as parents, if we can, we will, but you're going to take the major responsibility for it, and you have to take into account how much it's going to cost and keep the amount of help that you need down to a reasonable level. And some of you grew up in households like that. Responsibility for yourself, no extra frills, there's not a lot of money. Then you put together another family that has a very different set of standards. They have told their kids, you can go anywhere you want, it's your right, you can expect us to pay entirely for college, we can afford to do that, that's the expectation. And sure, we'll, maybe not a Mini Cooper, but we'll at least rent you an old Jeep, or lease you a car, a cheap one, while you're in college. We'll provide for that. We'll let you put money on the credit card, just as long as you're reasonable. And then those people, for some reason, are attracted to each other when they get divorced, and they marry, and now they've got two sets of kids, one of which expects to go to the local community college and pay for it, and the other set who have been promised the world by their parents, and the remarriage conflict is potentially great. What happens if the parents decide, okay, we're not going to do it the way we promised you? How do you feel if the parents said, well, wait a minute, I've made these promises to the kids and we can afford it and this is what they're expecting, so this is what's going to happen for my kids. And the other parent is saying, whoa, irresponsible. Whoa, this is indulgent beyond belief. The parental conflict is there. And the parent then has the expectations of his or her own child, and then you have potentially the conflict between children. How parents sort that out is very important to maintain the potential relationships with each child for the parent and step-parent and not appear to be playing favorites. It's a very difficult balance if people have brought different expectations into the relationship. Let me add something to that. And it's very difficult, particularly if you try to create a new set of expectations for kids, and then you have the other parent blaming you because you've changed the expectations, and supporting the kids feeling cheated. Well, you told us we could go any place we wanted, so I only applied to Ivy League schools, and you're supposed to pay for all of it, and the parent now says, well, I can't do that, and we're not going to do that. Then you have not only the kids mad at you, but you have an ex-spouse who's saying, this is the result of your mother's divorce, this is what happened to you, and it's all her fault, and you can blame her, and you've all heard those arguments. Some of you have heard those arguments. I'm sorry, Colin. They had two more kids, right? Right. Yeah. And what parents do often is have their own joint child, who is the biological child of both of them, so they're both involved in that child, and the half siblings, the children from previous unions, now are, okay, we're not going to devote quite as much to you because we can join together in doting on and raising this biological child who represents our new union and you're part of the past. There's potential there for a sense of rejection that some of you have described. Enough? Let me mention briefly some of the other macro system changes. On the left is the way it used to be, and the macro system has changed in the direction of the viewpoints on the right. We used to throw a parent out, and now in most states, you don't have to prove the other person is unfit to get a divorce. Most states allow divorce on the basis of irreconcilable differences. The couple agree they can't get back together, they don't want to get back together, nobody is really nasty enough, but they don't want to be together anymore. And courts will accept that, so you don't have to prove the other person was unfaithful or abusive. Alimony used to be expected, and that was one of the reasons for proving the other person was at fault. The more fault, the more alimony. Now in most states, you can expect some spousal support while you get on your feet, but what you're really going to get is limited and temporary. And what's of more interest is support for children. We still, in some states, talk about custody. Most states have moved to talking about parenting. So instead of a custody arrangement, you have a parenting schedule. The focus is not on keeping the kid in handcuffs or in a drawer someplace because you have custody of it, but being a responsible parent. And the child having the expectation that the parents will still be involved. And most states now expect both parents to continue to be supportive and involved in the child's life. Visitation, no, you spend time with. You have a parenting schedule. You're not visiting your parents. You don't visit your parents. Well, in college, you go home and you're in that transition period. In that transition period. When they don't have a room for you anymore and you have to sleep on the couch, then maybe you're visiting. But there's a point when you visit your parents because it's no longer home. But that's not the case for children whose parents have divorced. It's no longer a broken home, it's a divorced family. No longer a single parent family, but binuclear. We spend less time thinking about parental rights and more time talking about parental responsibilities. How are you going to share those responsibilities as parents? And we've moved toward the best interests of the child as the principle underlying all of the decisions that get made that will affect the child. And each of those, as part of the macro system, reflects consistencies across different courts, different states, different ways of of thinking about divorce, particularly as it affects children, and a different view of the ecosystem, a more complex view of the ecosystem that children are in when their parents divorce. You have questions? That, by the way, is sort of a review. You can take all of the elements of developmentology and apply it to that particular case. Let me throw out a couple of others. If you want to practice with developmentology, think about what an affair does. How would you describe, developmentologically, a parental affair, extramarital affair? And how would you design an ecosystem? This would be a great final exam question. How would you design an ecosystem so that it would support extramarital affairs and make them positive for children's development? I don't know if you can. Could you use developmentology to support, to design a macro system and a mesosystem in which extramarital affairs would not be destructive? I don't know. You'd have to change the macro system, obviously. Well, you'd have to change the macro system. It'd have to be a different country with a different tradition. But how would you design it just for fun? Right. Yeah, communal living might work. So you might think about different kinds of extramarital sexual relationships. Group marriage, that was a fun book. Group marriage, serious proposal to allow groups of people to marry each other. This is an interesting suggestion for how you would change, how you would create a microsystem that included several people in it, raising children, having sexual relationships in different directions among the adults. Okay. Sounds like Utah. I'm sorry, it is Utah. Swinging. Right. To pick up 7 days. Couples seeking. How many of you read the... Of course you do. It's the most entertaining. I read them. It's okay to read about it. Just don't do it. Couples seeking. Another couple. Bi female. Couple seeking group. Whatever turns you on. You can describe any of those potential relationships developmentologically and perhaps think of a way that you could make it work under certain circumstances. What questions did you bring in? What don't you understand yet? Okay, another potential final exam question just occurred to me. How do you describe the change when parents, grandparents, move in with a nuclear family? What happens when you take a grandparent in? Or two of them? What's likely to happen to the microsystem? And I was reminded about that partly by the notion of a commune, but partly because I was thinking about a particular student several years ago who wrote her her version of exercise 4 about that event when her mother, her grandmother moved in with the family during a very, very long and protracted terminal illness. And the student was able to write about her relationship with her grandmother and helping take care of her and the relationship that they established and what that did for her right on through her grandmother's death, including being with her when her grandmother died. It was very interesting, very powerful paper to look at developmentologically. She talked about the roles, the motor activities, the affect, changed relationships with her parents and with her siblings, with extended family as she took on this much more complex role, and what it did for her as she came into human development and family studies and moved on toward becoming a family therapist. Interesting. So that's where that one came from. Okay, what I would like to do is wish for you many wonderful primary dyads in your life with positive affect, a high degree of reciprocity, and a comfortable balance of power. Many developmental dyads. You should have developmental dyads all your life. In both directions. You're the less developed and the more developed. I would like to give you a lifetime of satisfying molar activities, some joint, harmonious, secure, and supportive home microsystems, both the ones that you join and the ones that you create, a richly linked mesosystem, including settings that are engaging, challenging, and rewarding, an exosystem favorably disposed to your development, developmental trajectories through increasingly satisfying, rewarding, and productive settings that will allow you to pay your bills, promoting patterns of motivation and activity that serve you and your society well. I would wish for you the ability to understand your ecosystem and to manage it effectively so that it supports your development and the development of those for whom you care. I wish for you opportunities to participate in a wide variety of macrosystems, steady progress in the development of a more differentiated and valid view of your ecosystem, and the skills necessary to maintain and improve your ecosystem. And Julie and I thank you very much for a fun and interesting semester. See you at review sessions and at the finals.